Tonight on Arena, we celebrate Jane Austen on her 250th birthday, and Lisa Hannigan joins us ahead of tonight's Other Voices Home event. You're very welcome along to Tuesday night's Arena 51551. To text us, our WhatsApp is 0870 32 32 32, email arena at rte.ie, and we are on Instagram at rte_arena. The temptation to begin this introduction to celebrating the 250th birthday of Jane Austen involving a witty and apposite reworking of her most famous line involving truths being universally acknowledged is overwhelming, so here goes. It is a truth universally acknowledged that one of the greatest writers who ever lived was a woman who wrote six perfect novels, wrote copiously with the support of her loving family, corresponded fervently with her adored and adoring sister, and yet when she died at the pitifully young age of 41, her sister Cassandra burned all her letters. And yet her novels lived and live on, never mind the myriad adaptations on TV and film. Think of Mr. Darcy emerging from the lake at Pemberley, or Marianne desperately running over the rain-washed fields in Sense and Sensibility. Think beyond the bonnets to the soul and passion that exists within the pages of an Austen novel, as well as Regency life and the workings of modern life, from the desperate plight of the unmarried woman to the background throne of slavery and the Napoleonic Wars, but also to love and marriage, all written with superlative style and unimprovable wit. Later in the show, we'll be talking about those novels of Jane Austen. First, I'm joined by author Jill Hornby, who has written her own Austen-influenced best-selling books, including Miss Austen, which was a major BBC drama earlier this year. But even more importantly, she is also honorary president of the Jane Austen Society. Hello, Jill. You're very welcome to Arena.
Thank you for having me.
Happy Jane Austen's birthday. Do you celebrate?
Well, I'm doing quite a lot of interviews. The whole world seems to be celebrating, which is fantastic.
When did you first come across her work?
When I was at school, I had one of those inspirational life-changing, and she really did change my life, actually, English teacher. And she was a Janeite, and she sort of infected me with her passion for all of Austen's novels and sort of civilised me in the process.
What was it about her initially that took your attention?
Well, I think it was the psychological credibility of her characters. You know, that I had read other classics and none of the characters had ever seemed as familiar to me as the Austen ones. You can pluck them out of an Austen novel and apply them to modern life and they are entirely unchanged, despite the difference in our environments. And the other thing is that she made me laugh, which no classic author had accomplished until that moment.
It's rare enough that an author reaches something like it's rare enough that an author reaches something like this, like a 250th anniversary, and is still somebody who is being read and talked about. Why do you think so many people are still obsessed by all things Jane Austen?
Well, it's so interesting, isn't it? Because at the time she was writing, she was not the most celebrated author. And Walter Scott probably thought that, you know, on his 250th birthday, the nation would stop and the bells would chime. But that doesn't really happen. Jane was she was a sort of successful but not a major novelist in her lifetime. It's almost as if we appreciate her more. As I say, I think the psychological realism of the books, the fact that she, which was not appreciated by her contemporaries, invented the rom-com, really helped. Putting jokes in, you know, seeing that life is funny, that you cannot actually live life without finding something amusing, is really crucial. And it is amazing how many fine novelists forget that element. And then it is her weird adaptability to the screen that no other author has. And so she lives on, her popularity has gone nuts, and she has enormously passionate fan base, a lot of whom haven't even read the books. You know, they couldn't engage with the text at all if you asked them to, but they love the stories in the films. And that has clearly contributed to her success.
In terms of the books themselves, I'm interested to know what you think. Do you think that some people never dive in because there is that perception that it is all just bonnets and clipped accents and romance?
I think a lot of men don't dive in, I have to say. There does seem to be a male resistance, which is very different from over the last 200 years. When she was published, it was men who reviewed her favourably, and there was absolutely no distinction between novels by women and novels by men. You know, that we have this terrible blindness, but they didn't have it. And then she was sort of almost going out of fashion before she died at her incredibly young age of 41, and then started to build again in Victorian times. And really, her success got a shot in the arm in the First World War, when it was men in the trenches who were sending home for her books, possibly because that idea of that she was created in England, you know, which was a wonderful image to them as they were out, stuck out there in the mud, you know. And so it was men in the trenches and then soldiers in the Second World War. They really, they took refuge in her books. Now, in the 21st century, she is thought of as a woman's author, and a lot of women will read her and love her, but simply not enough men pick the books up, which is frustrating.
The humour is a really interesting point, isn't it? Because humour isn't something that necessarily survives the decades, let alone surviving the centuries, but hers has. So why do you think that is?
I don't know. It's so acute and it's so based on people. The other thing is her dialogue is so fantastic that you can just plonk it in a film or TV script, totally unchanged, and everyone will get it and laugh. She just had a very modern take on things. She was way ahead in her modernity to everybody else who was writing then. Her language was more approachable, even though people now find it quite off-putting. But her prose really was much simpler and more approachable. And her dialogue is just a hoot.
Tell me about Jane's sister, Cassandra. Jane was very close to her, but she did burn most or all of her sister's letters on her death. When did you first learn about Cassandra?
Well, I first learned about her when I moved into the house in which I now live. And the house I live in was built on the site of a house that the Austins knew well. And the connection was that Cassandra was engaged to the second son of the vicar at the time. And it was the perfect match. So she had her destiny. She was all set and going off. She was 3 years older than Jane. And that was what she was going to do. And then tragedy intervened and she never married. And so she rather began to haunt me because I did history at university and it was the late 70s and it was the history of men, in the words of men, taught entirely by men. And though I wasn't obsessed with my university work, it did occasionally occur to me that we weren't mentioning the other 50% of the population at all, unless it was queens, and we haven't had that many of them. And that is because we kind of had this assumption that all women got married and had children, and that was the end of them. And Jane's novels give us that assumption, you know, the altar, they end at the altar, that's the triumph, off she goes with her life. In fact, fewer than 40% of women got married in that time. So what happened to the rest of them? How did they make it through? Because the financial insecurity of women was really life-crippling. So I began to be quite obsessed with Cassandra, who lost her fiancé at the age of 23, 24, but lived to 74. How did she support herself? How did she invent another destiny for herself? Then I was asked to write a biography of Austin for younger readers, for 8 to 12-year-olds. And first I read the biographies and discovered they all hated Cassandra because she burnt the letters. Then I read the memoirs of the nieces and nephews who, and learnt that they had no time for Cassandra because she wasn't, they were comparing her to the sparkling, brilliant genius, Jane, who'd very sensibly died at 41 when she could be remembered as a young woman and not an old woman. Then I read Jane's letters to Cassandra, the 160, which is quite a lot, by the way, that Cassandra has let down to us. And I realised that Jane, who was absolutely not a sufferer of fools, worshipped Cassandra completely, totally looked up to her. She was the, you know, she was the chief in their relationship. And so I really wanted to write something in defence of Cassandra against this general public perception of her, because she looked after Jane. Jane was a fragile person. She was a genius, and they often are a very fragile bunch. And Cassandra was, you know, like the wife to a great man. She facilitated the art. She got her through the dark years, and they had dark years. And then she facilitated the novels, and then she protected the reputation and was the keeper of the flame. Unfortunately, we know hardly anything about her because she burned everything of her own as well. So I couldn't write a non-fiction book. I had to write a novel. So I did. It was called Miss Austen. And so the burning of the letters, there are innocent explanations like space. You know, there would be thousands of letters between them because Cassandra was always being called away. And Cassandra was at the end of her life. The cottage was to be sold after her death, and where would they all go? Another thing is that they wrote very frankly between one another because they had no secrets. And they had a lot of sisters-in-law who got on their nerves. So there would have been, I think, a lot of bitchy stuff in there, and she wanted to save people's feelings. And then the other thing is this idea of legacy management, which was a big thing of those days and a possible thing. We can't possibly now control the evidence we leave about ourselves because we littered the world with ourselves, you know, with emails and WhatsApps and thoughtless things everywhere that may well be preserved. But in those days, you could. It was only the pen on the page that was testament to your life. And so she could edit. And as I say, Jane was very acerbic. And she did also, I think, suffer from enormous melancholy in their difficult years together. And so she would have been keen to present a much more even, you know, uncontroversial version of her sister. And also, by the way, I would say she did treasure 161 letters. And Jane had six brothers, and she would have written to all of them, and we've got about two or three. So they didn't preserve any because they didn't think they were worth preserving. So that's another thing we should thank Cassandra for, is that we at least have those, which are very useful to us.
Maybe just to finish, and given the day that it is, and I realise this is possibly an impossible question, do you have a favourite Austen novel, or does that vary from week to week, day to day, whatever mood you're in?
Well, it's sort of varied age to age, I think. It was Pride and Prejudice first, and then I got old and it became Persuasion. But the more I think about it all and the more I write about her, it has to be Emma now, which is, I think, her masterpiece. It wasn't until Cassandra wrestled a cottage out of their rich brother and they were able to settle in it and they had a roof over their head that Jane produced any novels at all. She had written versions of Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, and Northanger Abbey, but they weren't in sort of publishable form. But they got to Chawton and she got out all her manuscripts and Cassandra sort of gave her a kick up the bottom and she got on with it. And so first published Sense and Sensibility, then Pride and Prejudice, then Mansfield Park. And during that time she had started off writing rather imitative novels of the sort that had gone before her. And then when she got to Emma, it came out in 2015. When she wrote it, which she did in a year, it is a perfect novel. It's a long novel. Every sentence is just crystal. And she wrote it longhand in a year. She was a published author. Nobody knew who she was. She had total freedom. And she thought, I'm going to experiment. And the first thing she did was create a heroine who was nothing like her. All her other heroines are poor and face jeopardy if they don't marry somebody. Emma, handsome, clever and rich, she can do what she likes. So that was like a thought experiment. What on earth was it like to be one of those rare beings that didn't actually have to worry about any of it? And another thing is she wrote in a form that had never been tried before, which is called free and direct speech. And she invented it. And it's now how we write all modern novels and how all modern readers expect novels to be written, which is the narrative comes from inside the head of one of the main characters. But with Emma, it was the first time it had ever been tried. So there she was, an unknown woman sitting in this little cottage, blowing the walls off the novel form for the first time and actually changing it forever.
Jill Hornby, thank you so much for talking to us on tonight's Arena.
Thank you for having me.
Miss Austen and Godmersham Park by Jill Hornby are published by Penguin. And you're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. We are sticking with the Jane Austen theme because, as we've been saying, on this day 250 years ago, Jane Austen was born in Steventon in Hampshire. TV and film adaptations of her works have become absolute classics in their own right. Who can forget the simmering chemistry between Mr. Darcy and Elizabeth Bennet in Pride and Prejudice, culminating in some of the most romantic moments ever seen on the screen. Don't worry, we'll get to it. Birthday celebrations are underway globally amongst her devoted fans known as Janeites, and there are televised treats in store for everyone in the weeks and the months to come. So what is it about Jane Austen that compels us not just to read and to reread the books, but to absolutely devour anything associated with her? I'm delighted to be joined by two people who can hopefully shed some light on her enduring popularity. Dr. Michelle O'Connell is a lecturer in Romantic Literature in the School of English Drama and Film in UCD, and Jarlath Killeen is Professor of Victorian English in Trinity College, Dublin. You're both very welcome to the programme. Where am I going to start with this? We've heard Jill Hornby's thoughts on this. Maybe Jarlath, I'll start with you on this. 250 years on, what do you think that makes Jane Austen's appeal still so universal?
So I think there's a few ways you could approach this. I mean, one is to consider as this almost providing a kind of quintessence of Englishness, English comfort, a kind of romanticised version of the English past, heritage England, as it's often called. And certainly if you look at the way readers have responded to her throughout, you know, the last couple of centuries, she appears to have provided comfort to people. So there's stories of soldiers reading her work in the trenches of the First World War, because she provided for them some kind of avenue back home and a particular version of home, a particular version of England. So I think that that's really important, that for whatever reason, she's been considered a very safe, comforting, comfortable writer. Now, whether that's an accurate reading of her or not is a different question, but that certainly has been one strand of the approach to her in the last 250 years. Another strand which has been very important is this sense of her as the best writer for romance, as in romance in terms of popular romance stories. That Pride and Prejudice is essentially the kind of origin text of the entire popular romance genre. And I think that, again, scholars are uncomfortable with that particular reading of it. But in fact, that, you know, you can certainly trace even some Mills and Boone romances, popular romances based in the Regency period. They all kind of come back to this sense that Austen did it best and we're going to draw from her. So I think she's the origin of a particular kind of Englishness and a particular idea of romantic love. And that's really important, I think, for her readers.
I'm interested to know why scholars would be uncomfortable with that read.
I think... this is changing. Certainly, it's changed in the last 10 to 15 years. But scholars have always been uncomfortable with the romance plot, the plot that involves, you know, the happy ever after ending, and that's all geared towards this this coming together of two people overcoming obstacles and getting together in a marriage at the end. And, you know, the popular romance itself is a kind of degraded genre and has been traditionally looked down upon. So you often find scholars, when they write about Austen, saying things like that, that the love story is not the most important aspect and there's much more going on here. And look what happens at the end. She's not really that interested in the love match because she rushes the ending. She doesn't really show the proposal scene. We're told about the proposal third hand or second hand. We don't get to see the marriages, so that's not really that important. It's all about the quest, it's all about the narrative, there's lots of other things going on. But readers like the romance, and we have to kind of get with that. It's an emotional reaction, emotional relationship that people have with her.
Michelle, given that you're a lecturer in romantic literature, I presume you are not uncomfortable with this at all.
I am not at all. I was a fan before I was an academic. I think if you look at her popular appeal, she knows people. She really understands relationships. You know, you're familiar with everyone in her books. You've met someone of them in your life. You've seen the games that people play. She writes them out so precisely, and she doesn't waste words. If you go back to watching the TV adaptations or the films, it's her dialogue. Her dialogue is so perfectly placed. And it's also sparse. It's kind of almost hard to put your finger on what's good about her writing alongside the romance, because it's so, what would I say? It's so difficult to define because it's so good. She almost hides her craft beneath that sparse dialogue. And I think at the same time, she manages to get real feeling in there almost through not saying things. Things left to your imagination.
It's an interesting point about her dialogue being changed very little in modern adaptations, because there are very few writers that you can say that about. You can say that about Shakespeare frequently, you can say that about her, but it's a relatively unusual thing to come across in modern adaptations of literature from 200 years ago and beyond.
Absolutely. And every time I return to the books, I'm sort of reminded, oh, that line is actually in the book. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought that was just Donald Sutherland saying something, you know, but it really is in there. So, yeah, I mean, as a teenager, she used to write funny plays with her family and they'd put on drama and things. So she's very familiar with the theatre. Mm-hmm. And I think that it comes from that as well. She's very familiar with plays. She's put them on, she's acted them out. She's sort of written satires on them and things like that. So she's very good with structure and dialogue and things like that.
And she read aloud her novels as she was writing them to her family, and I presume getting reactions, you know, this bit is good, this bit is funny, and I'm going to keep that line in. So she's kind of experimenting on a very receptive audience of her own family.
Well, let's remind people listening of those lines and that dialogue. We'll take this from Pride and Prejudice from the 2005 version. This is Keira Knightley as Elizabeth Bennet and Matthew McFadden as Mr. Darcy. Mr. Darcy has just confessed his feelings for Elizabeth, but emphasising her lower social standing probably was not the smartest move.
No, there was, however, I have to admit, the matter of your family.
Our want of connection. Mr. Bingley didn't seem to vex himself
more
about
than that.
How, sir?
It was the lack of propriety shown by your mother, your three younger sisters, even on occasion your father. Forgive me. You and your sister, I must exclude this.
And what about Mr. Wickham?
Mr. Wickham.
What excuse can you give for your behaviour towards him?
You take an eager interest in that gentleman's concerns.
He told me of his misfortunes.
Oh, yes, his misfortunes have been very great indeed.
You ruin his chances and yet you treat him with sarcasm.
So this is your opinion of me. Thank you for explaining so fully. Perhaps these offences might have been overlooked had not your pride been hurt by my honesty in admitting scruples about our relationship. Could you expect me to rejoice in the inferiority of your circumstances?
And those are the words of a gentleman. From the first moment I met you, your arrogance and conceit, your selfish disdain for the feelings of others, made me realise that you were the last man in the world I could ever be prevailed upon to marry.
Forgive me, madam, for taking up so much of your time.
That is peak Jane Austen right there. Talk to me a little bit, Jarlath, about kind of modern comparisons that are drawn with, you know, some people view some of the characters in her novels as archetypes, and they tend to see them everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, one of the more striking ones is the popularity of the Keeping Up with the Kardashians, which has essentially the same kind of family structure with the Bennet family in the in Pride and Prejudice. So we have this mom manager, or manager, I think they're sometimes referred to, trying to find suitable partners for her five daughters. And so I think, in a sense, what they're trying to do is modernise Pride and Prejudice to a certain extent. Now, obviously Keeping Up with the Kardashians has gone on and on. But I think that's part of the original attraction of something like Keeping Up with the Kardashians. It taps into that archetype of this mother trying to find the right kind of partners for her girls.
Michelle, you're nodding. Do you see Jane Austen characters everywhere?
Yeah, I mean, she originates this sort of love-hate thing. And, you know, Elizabeth is the outspoken, you know, maybe even early feminist in her novels. She never really topped Elizabeth, but any sprightly heroine is really modelled on Elizabeth Bennet. And Mrs. Bennet, you know... as well as, you know, the Jenners and the Kardashians, she is the original annoying elderly mother trying to get rid of her children and trying to plot and control. And she actually has a lot of sort of controlling older mother figures in the books, which are less comical than Mrs. Bennet. But, you know, you do see that replicated. You do see poor relationships between children and parents through sort of damage related to financial issues, damage related to relationships, and how families can fall apart from that.
How important do you think that these adaptations, big screen adaptations on TV, have been to the continuing appeal of Austen and the fact that never really seems to wane?
Well, I think it's huge. I think the 1995 Pride and Prejudice brought a real resurgence to interest in Jane Austen. And it made Jane Austen sexy, especially, you know, the water cooler moment where Colin Firth dives into the pool and comes out totally soaked and in transparent clothing. And I think that was a moment in culture as well where you have this sort of strong, silent man. His defence is being broken down by Elizabeth Bennet. And, you know, that's a relationship you see everywhere in romantic comedy. And the plot of Pride and Prejudice is the basis for, you know, every Hallmark movie, all of these romantic commentaries, comedies, like even something like The Proposal with Sandra Bullock and Ryan Reynolds. It's everywhere. And I think that brings readership back to Austen, and because Austen is such an accessible writer, even though she wrote 200 years ago, it's still very easy to read her. We mightn't read other writers of the time so easily. But again, her writing is so sparse that it's quite easy to get to grips with quite quickly.
Jareth, maybe explain to me the idea of Austen's popularity stretching beyond her work. There's this desire to inhabit her world and have a personal connection with her that seems to have lasted through the ages as well.
I can give you a kind of two concrete examples. One is of a film called Austenland, in which this character becomes so obsessed with Jane Austen that she books herself on this kind of fantasy scenario where you get to live as a Jane Austen character for a couple of weeks in an English big house and meet other people who are similarly obsessed with Jane Austen. And while that's a joke, and it's quite funny, the idea of Austenland, I think, is actually really important. People want to live like Jane Austen characters, even if only for a while. There's another film which somebody obsessed with Jane Austen steps into the screen, that they're watching an adaptation, and they actually step into the screen and become part of the adaptation. That's how kind of an emotional connection people have to Jane Austen and her books. Even calling people who are fans of Jane Austen Janeites strikes me as very different than, for example, people who are interested in Dickens don't call themselves Charlieites, or, you know, or people who are interested in Oscar Wilde don't call themselves Oscarians. They call themselves Wildians. Why do we use the first name when we're talking about Jane Austen? Why is it Jane? Why is it our Jane? As if she's a friend. She's some kind of companion that we have. And of course, people and maybe even almost like a saint to a certain extent. They get trying to get hold of her possessions. So there's an interesting story where Kelly Clarkson, the American pop singer, bids on and wins in an auction one of Austin's rings or something like that, some kind of jewellery that Austin owned. And she wanted it because touching it would bring her closer to Jane Austen, the same way that relics would bring you close to a saint. And so outraged were the British public when this piece of Jane Austen was going to leave England that the culture secretary at the time, was Labour Secretary Ed Vasey, I think, intervened and actually put an export tax on this piece of jewellery, saying it couldn't leave. And in fact, then the money was raised to buy it back from Kelly Clarkson, and she said she was happy enough to sell it back to the British state, but I'm sure she wasn't really that happy because she wanted some kind of concrete connection to this person that she had idolised.
Okay, let's take something else, and this is from the 1995 version of Sense and Sensibility. This is Emma Thompson as Eleanor Dashwood, Kate Winslet as her younger sister Marianne. Marianne's fallen in love with the dashing John Willoughby, but he sends her a letter ending their romance abruptly, which breaks her heart.
My esteem for your family is very sincere, but if I have given rise to a belief of more than I felt or meant to express, I shall reproach myself for not having been more guarded. My affections have long been engaged elsewhere, and it is with great regret that I return your letters and the lock of hair which you so obligingly bestowed upon me. I am, etc., John Willoughby.
Oh, Marianne. Dearest. It is best to know what his intentions are at once. Think of what you would have felt if your engagement had carried on for months and months before he chose to put an end to it.
We're not engaged.
But you wrote to him. I thought then he must have left you with some kind of understanding.
No. He's not so unworthy as you think him.
Not so unworthy? Did he tell you that he loved you?
Yes. No. Never absolutely. It was every day implied, but never declared. Sometimes I thought it had been, but it never was. He has broken no vow.
Yes, he's broken faith with all of us. He made us all believe he loved you.
He did. He did. He loved me as I loved him.
Michelle, I understand that there was speculation about her brief relationship with an Irishman, a guy called Tom Lefroy.
Tom Lefroy,
and that
yes.
He might have been an important character.
He might well have been, because the first version of Pride and Prejudice, called First Impressions, was written directly after his potential relationship with Jane Austen. Now, we don't have a lot of information on this because her sister Cassandra, of course, destroyed a lot of her letters. And if there was a diary, we don't have it. But we do have some letters describing what seems to be a relationship with this guy. So Tom Lefroy was a nephew of a family that the Austens associated with, some neighbours. And Tom visited his uncle and aunt in 1796 and spent a lot of time chatting with this young woman called Jane Austen. And they went to three balls together and danced and spoke. And she calls him my Irish friend. And she says that they did everything most profligate and shocking in the way of dancing and sitting down together. And she at one point suggests that she's expecting an offer of marriage from him, which doesn't come. And in a letter describing this to Cassandra, she says, "At last the day has come on which I am to flirt my last with Tom Lefroy. And when you receive this, it will be over. My tears flow as I write at the melancholic idea." And Tom went home and married a Wexford heiress and later became Lord Chief Justice of Ireland. He's buried in Harold's Cross. But he did, towards the end of his life, confess that he was in love with her. So we don't know how deep this relationship went. We don't think that they corresponded, but there was definitely something there. And was he the original figure for Mr. Darcy?
You could see how he might be an inspiration for something like that.
You could.
I understand you have quite strong feelings about adaptations of Jane Austen that then mm-hmm. move into the more modern and then make changes. Is that something you're for or against?
I think a balance has to be struck. I think her dialogue is so good, as we've already spoken about, it's a shame to change it. And I think when you start messing with the basic plot of the novel and things like that, trying to make it more modern, it comes a cropper. So I'm thinking,
is it safe to say you're not a fan of Clueless?
Clueless I like, because that's out and out modernised. I'm okay with that. That's inventive. That's building on the pattern rather than pretending that the pattern is modern. I think I really like the way that Clueless is so accessible to a younger audience. The 2022 Persuasion, I would be very much not of the same opinion. I think when I began watching it and Anne Elliot pulled out her playlist that she'd been given from Captain Wentworth, I sort of rolled my eyes a bit. The playlist consisted of sheet music bound with a ribbon. So, you know,
early mixtape.
Yes, exactly. So it was really discordant. And I think that the fact that Anne Elliot, who is a really put upon figure in her family, was sort of remade into this sort of chirpy Elizabeth Bennet figure, sort of ruined the whole point of the book. Well, for me anyway, because it's probably my favourite. And I'm sure people will disagree with me. I'm sure people enjoyed the film. But I can't, I couldn't accept what had happened to the book in this movie.
Journalist, we should remember that Austen was writing at a time when the genre of the novel itself wasn't necessarily seen as being a good thing or a positive thing by many people.
Well, that's right. I suppose the early history of the novel is that it's, you know, it's something that might fall into the hands of women, first of all. I mean, that was a big problem. And it also might fall into the hands of lower class women in particular. So it had a kind of degraded position, really, next to poetry, which was the major form of writing. By the time Austen was writing, so Sir Walter Scott had, in a sense, masculinized the novel to a certain extent and made it more respectable. But he did like Jane Austen's novels. He did give her quite a strong review and, you know, see her as, along with somebody like Mariah Edgeworth, as a, you know, a worthy novelist, a good novelist. So by the time she's writing, the novel is becoming more respectable, and she's part of that emerging respectability.
Although I think, as Jill Hornby pointed out earlier on, they're not exactly ringing the bells for Walter Scott's birthday every year. Anita, right. Lovely text from Anita, who said, "Publishers limit Jane Austen's readership by repackaging her as chick lit in pink pastel and floral book covers. Mansfield Park deals with infidelity, alcoholism, class inequality, slavery and colonialism, to name just a few themes. It was Jane's favourite novel. She chose a grittier novel. Scrap the pink fluffy covers." With an exclamation mark from Anita, a fan. Anita, thank you.
Can I say I don't object to it, because I don't, again, why see chick lit as a problem? Why see it as a degraded form? Why see it as a lesser form? And it does, chick lit finds its origin in Bridget Jones's Diary. That's often considered the origin text. And what is Bridget Jones's Diary but a version, in a sense, of Pride and Prejudice, that's drawing constantly on Pride and Prejudice. So in a sense, Jane Austen is the origin point of chick lit as well as modern romance. So I actually don't have a problem with the connection between it, because I don't see chick lit as a problem. I don't see it as a, you know, it does what it's meant, it does what it's trying to do. And there's some good chick lit, there's some bad chick lit.
We could do this for the rest of the evening, but thank you so much for talking to us. Dr. Michelle O'Connell, lecturer in Romantic Literature at the School of English, Drama and Film at UCD, and Jarlath Killeen, the Professor of Victorian English at Trinity College Dublin. Thanks for joining us on Arena this evening. Jane Austen will be dominating our screens in the months to come. In 2026, the BBC will broadcast a Pride and Prejudice spin-off, The Other Bennet Sister, centering on Mary, the unassuming middle child. If you follow Richard E. Grant on Instagram, you'll have seen him put up the trailer for that today. While Netflix has enlisted best-selling author Dolly Alderton for an adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. The six-part series will have amongst its stars, allegedly, Emma Corrin and Jack Loudon as Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy, as well as Academy Award winner Olivia Colman as Mrs. Bennet. We will have to wait and see. Welcome back. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena.
You see for the day. He wanted to know what to say when he's asked what he'd done in the past to someone that he loved endlessly. Now she's gone, so is he. I went to war every morning. I lost my way, but now I'm following what you said in my arm, what I read in the charm that I love durably. Now it's dead.
Singer, songwriter and multi-instrumentalist Lisa Hannigan has been a stalwart of the folk music scene for more than two decades. Her solo career started in 2008 with her Mercury-nominated debut album, See So. She also recorded two other studio albums, Passenger and At Swim, but tonight Lisa returns to Dublin's iconic Guinness Storehouse for a special performance at Other Voices Home. The festival, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary, has a theme of homecoming. Lisa's going to be performing along with the Theodora Byrne Trio, Rachel Chinnariri, Spirits, Brogale and the poet Paula Meehan. And Lisa joins me now. We just played Leal there from See So as well. Lisa, you're very welcome to Arena, first of all.
Thank you for having me.
It's hard to believe that that song is almost 20 years old. It still sounds like it could have been recorded yesterday. I mean, how do you feel when you hear that song these days?
Well, thank you very much. You know, I always remember when I hear that song on the radio, I always remember hearing it on the radio for the very, very first time. And I remember driving through Dublin and bursting into tears. So I'm sort of reminded of that, but it was a very long time ago. I feel like that when I'm singing it, you know, actually.
Yeah, was it one of those first times when you kind of heard your music not being part of yourself, if you know what I mean? Because obviously when you're performing it yourself on stage, it is part of you and it's part of what you're doing, but it's entirely separate to you when you hear it on something like the radio.
I think that's right. I think the radio seems like it feels a bit more official, you know, it's more officially in the world than playing it at your kitchen table. It was a moment. It was a special moment for sure.
I want to talk to you about a few things. I saw you a while back on Instagram. You were singing a Joni Mitchell song. Was it Coyote you were getting ready to perform? And this was
a
whole Joni Mitchell thing you were doing, and you were playing, I think it was a dulcimer. I think I have that right. How did that whole idea for those series of gigs come about, the Joni Mitchell songs?
Oh, yeah, it was a wonderful set of gigs. It was Lael Arad and Kate Stables from This Is The Kit and Jessica Hoop. Had sung a Joni Mitchell song at her 80th birthday, so celebrations in London, and thought, actually, why don't we do a whole gig where it's just ladies singing Joni Mitchell songs? This sounds like the best day ever. And they've been doing that for a while. It was actually Kate Stables with the dulcimer. I will not claim it. In fact, I had to farm out the guitar part for Coyote to my good friend Sam Killeen, because Joni is no slouch in the guitar department either. So it's hard enough learning all the words to Joni Mitchell songs, let alone trying to play an instrument at the same time.
Was that a song?
It's a beautiful show.
Was that a song that you picked yourself? Because Coyote, I think, is my favourite Joni Mitchell song.
Really?
Yeah.
It was one I picked myself. Yeah, they very kindly sort of let everybody follow their own noses when it came to that. But yes, such a beautiful song. But it's a mouthful. You know, there's four really stonking verses to learn. It took me a few months to really feel confident enough to sing it. But yeah, she's such an amazing storyteller. And actually, weirdly, Joni Mitchell songs are kind of easy to learn because they are such stories. You know, each line kind of leads into the next. There's nothing generic about it, or, you know, she's not there with a rhyming dictionary or anything. So
she very much has that. It is something that artists aspire to these days, that kind of authenticity of potentially talking about their own lives. And in a lot of songs, Coyote being one of them, it does sound like she's lived it.
Absolutely. And she really broke new ground by being so sort of viscerally honest and exposing of her own private life. You know, she was one of the first people to really take on that mantle. And she completely changed the way people view songwriting since. You know, she's such an original voice and remains as original today as she ever was.
Is that something you aspire to do in your own music, or is that something you're perfectly happy not to?
Yeah, oh no, absolutely. I mean, I don't necessarily want anyone knowing my business, but I feel like you have to be honest about your feelings in order for a song to have any kind of resonance at all. I mean, I don't put names and dates out there for for people to be able to check up. But I certainly emotionally, you know, I try to be as honest as possible, for sure.
In terms of collaboration, it seems to be something that you enjoy quite a lot, and seeking out collaborations, whether it's with other musicians or other writers. Is that something that lights up something for you? Is it something that you find very creatively rewarding?
I love it, yeah. I love just seeing how other people work as well. Like, it's such a private business, I think, sometimes, songwriting, you know, and it feels kind of embarrassing, the whole business. And actually, if you can meet somebody that you sort of have a vibe with, that you know, you feel sort of safe with almost, you know, that you can make suggestions and again, be honest about your feelings and the rest. If you can find someone that works with, it's so magical, you know, such a magical moment. It doesn't always work that way.
Since the last time we spoke to you, you sold out a residency at the Irish Arts Centre. I'm interested to know, how did you find New York this time around?
I found it very inspiring to be there. I was there with the Theodore Byrne trio that I'm playing with tonight. And it was very inspiring musically to be there and writing songs and playing new music. And it was sort of, you know, I live down the country now in a very tiny village, and so it was almost physically overwhelming in a way that it maybe felt 25 years ago when I first went. But it was great to be there. Yeah, it's always, it was a few years ago now, to be honest, but I had a great time.
Talk to me a little bit about new music, because the Live in Dublin album with Stargaze was, what, 2019 at this point? And At Swim is 9 years ago. What's happening with you and new music at the moment?
I know, God, that is quite embarrassing. I mean, I was never the most prolific person in the world now, ever. But I'm slowly working away. I've got I have a family now, so I'm kind of in the throes of that. I don't have as much wandering about, staring at the window time as I used to. In terms of songwriting, but I'm just sort of slowly getting there. I'm writing a lot of songs about space tractors, to be honest.
There is a market for that, you know.
It's very niche. It's very niche. Yeah.
Shortly tonight, you're going to be on stage at the Guinness Storehouse in Dublin. You know, if people are on the way there and they're listening to this at the moment, what can they expect from tonight, from the performance?
Well, I'm singing with my dream team of the Theodore Byrne Ensemble, and Theo, in lockdown, I think she started doing these amazing vocal arrangements for 30 people, to people's songs. And once lockdown was over and I started venturing out, I sort of said, could we do one for maybe 3 people and see how that goes? And so we've just had the last few years, we've just been working through loads of old songs, loads of new songs. And she just has the most extraordinary way of approaching a tune, which, yeah, she just blows my mind. I love backing vocals, and I always put loads of backing vocals on everything, but she has a completely different way of approaching it, which is just magic. And we're going to do a version of I'm Stretched on Your Grave, which is obviously a Sinead O'Connor song. We do it kind of a cappella with very close sort of crunchy harmonies, And then we're going to do a song called Christmas FM that I wrote with Lux Alma that came out last year. And we're going to do another Christmas song, The Low, from The Low record, just like Christmas, and some more things as well. But that's, yeah, it's going to be pretty Christmassy, I would say, this evening.
You sound, and correct me if I'm wrong, as being somebody who quite enjoys the whole run-up to Christmas, the whole idea of this, the whole finding songs that might fit into a time of year like this. Am I right?
I love Christmas music, I have to say. I absolutely love it, which is what my song Christmas FM is all about, how much I love it. For me, other voices as well is such a part of Christmas, because for the last 25 years, a lot of those Christmases I've spent down in Dingle. So, you know, other voices and that church in Dingle and Benners and all that, that's a big part of Christmas too, with the Christmas music going. So it's I love it. I love the whole thing. And even more now that I'm busier in the Christmas sense.
Tell me about your involvements with other voices over the years. It has been 25 years. I mean, how important is it to you, and maybe how important do you think it is to Irish live music in general?
I mean, for me, it's been so important. I mean, I was there in the very first year. I think we were all sort of sitting on the floor. I mean, it was very, very low-key in the church. And then when I did my first solo record, other voices welcomed me back, which was a big moment for me personally. You know, it was sort of when I first started out on my own. And I've sort of gone back with each record, and they've always just been incredibly supportive and nourishing of me as an artist and of so many Irish artists. You know, I think it's a real rite of passage for people to be in that church and to meet other musicians. And like, I met Saint Sister there. I went to see them play in the church and they absolutely blew my mind. And I asked them to come on tour with me on the spot, because I was just about to go on tour in Europe. And so they came on tour with me for like 6 weeks or something. We had an amazing time. So I think it's a real ecosystem that, you know, that and lots of just magic moments, both on stage and off, you know, where people meet and harmonize and all the rest is great.
Well, thanks a million for taking time to talk to us tonight. I know that you are on your way to the gig as we talk. Lisa Hannigan, thanks a million for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rick. Cheers.
Lisa Hannigan will be performing tonight at Other Voices Home at the Guinness Storehouse. Highlights from the show will be available to watch on the Other Voices YouTube channel after the show.
Tonight's producer was Sinead Egan. Paula Shields was our researcher, broadcast coordinator, Ollie Hamilton, and sound supervision by Mark Dwyer. John Creedon is next. I will talk to you tomorrow night from 7 o'clock.